Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
From the wilderness of Kodiak Island, Alaska, this is Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier with your host, Robin Bearfield. In a land full of peril and vicious animals, humans are the most dangerous predators of all.
On the evening of July 7th, 1979, a plane disappeared near Kodiak Island in fair weather and moderate seas. News agencies in Alaska reported little about the missing plane and its occupants. Although reports of the apparent fatal crash made more of a splash in Great Britain, official sources offered no comment about the loss of a man who had done so much to protect Britain against the USSR during the Cold War. Even now, the disappearance of Ian McIntosh is cloaked in secrecy, and many wonder if he died in the plane crash or if the accident was a cover story, allowing McIntosh to disappear. The 2012 book, The Life and Mysterious Disappearance of Ian McIntosh by Robert G. Folsom, explores everything the author could uncover about a brilliant man's secret life and mysterious disappearance.
Welcome to Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Robin Bearfield, and I'm broadcasting to you from the heart of the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge on Kodiak Island in Alaska.
Ian McIntosh grew up in a small village in the Scottish Highlands. His father spent his career in the Royal Navy, and Ian followed in his footsteps. On September 14, 1958, Ian entered Britannia Royal Naval College in Dartmouth. He served Britain during the heat of the Cold War, when Russia and the West frequently clashed and allotted a great deal of money and time to spying on each other. After graduating from Britannia, McIntosh served on the aircraft carrier HMS Centaur. Next, he served on the HMS Lion, and then the HMS Belfast. He was a lieutenant by this time, and the Admiralty recognized his intelligence and strong work ethic. Soon, he took on secret assignments from Naval Intelligence and was assigned to a secretive installation at Port Edgar, near Edinburgh. During much of his time in the Royal Navy, Ian McIntosh was not where the Navy said he was. His duties as a naval officer remain classified. In other words, he was a British spy. From 1962 to 1972, researchers can only guess at McIntosh's duties, but he was an aide to the Admiral of the Fleet, Lord Lewin. Part of his duties required him to handle secret dispatches and other classified data. He probably also undertook various spy missions. During his busy naval career, McIntosh found time to write five novels, primarily crime novels and police procedurals. In 1969, McIntosh married Sharon Carter, the daughter of a Royal Navy commander. Their first daughter, Zoe, was born in 1970, and their second daughter, Zemma, arrived in 1974. Sharon found that it was not easy being married to Ian McIntosh. He was frequently away from home on assignment, and Sharon never knew where he was or how to contact him. When he returned home, he couldn't talk about where he'd been or what he'd been doing. Sharon grew tired of Ian's frequent absences and his workaholic nature. They eventually divorced but remained friends. With the blessings of the Royal Navy, Ian wrote and produced the television series Warship in 1973. The Navy even loaned the production a ship to use in the series. In 1976, Ian McIntosh officially retired from the Royal Navy. But some believe his work as a British spy did not end then. Also in 1976, McIntosh was awarded the MBE, or Member of the British Empire, a decoration honoring distinguished service. It is uncertain why he received the award. No explanation was ever given for what he did to deserve the MBE. Even Ian's brother Lowry has no idea why the honor was bestowed upon him. After he retired from the Navy, Yorkshire Television Company in Leeds hired McIntosh to develop and write television shows. He tried his hand at writing comedy, but his real forte was writing drama, especially shows involving espionage. He had lived the life of a spy, and with his writing skill, he made the drama seem gritty and real. In 1978, The Sandbaggers aired on the BBC in Great Britain. The main character, Neil Burnside, played by actor Roy Marsden, was based on Ian McIntosh. The spy series is as far from a James Bond movie as possible. It was less about Burnside and his colleagues matching wits against the Russians than about the friction Burnside and his fellow spies faced with their superior officers, many of whom were politicians with no military experience. McIntosh wrote most of the episodes, and critics hailed the series as the best spy drama ever. Instead of beautiful women, exotic locales, and Aston Martin chases, the Sandbaggers showed dark drama, tense confrontations, and complex entanglements. McIntosh portrayed espionage as the serious business it was. In 1979, the network renewed the Sandbaggers for a third season. By early June that year, McIntosh had completed 4 of the 7 scripts that would make up the third season. He had outlined but had yet to write the 3 remaining scripts, but no one doubted he would finish them on time. The cast and crew of the series were thrilled when they learned one of the episodes would be shot in Malta. McIntosh did not plan to join the others in Malta. Instead, he had arranged a trip with his girlfriend Susan Insull and his good friend Graham Barber. They intended to fly to Honolulu and then to Anchorage before returning to London. Graham Barber, 41, was a British Airways captain who flew 747s. Susan Insull, 29, was the daughter of Douglas Insull, a former England cricket star. Susan was a production assistant in the BBC's television drama department. She and McIntosh, 38, had been dating for 2 years. The trio planned to be away from London for approximately 18 days. Ian's younger brother, Lowry, said he spent little time with his brother, but he returned to England from his home in Cape Town, South Africa, every few months to visit their parents. A few days before McIntosh planned to leave on his vacation, he learned Lowry was on his way to Scotland. Ian met Lowry at Heathrow Airport and spent the day with him. Ian then asked Lowry to meet him on his way from Scotland back to South Africa. Lowry would later say that Ian's behavior was very uncharacteristic. Ian said he wished Lowry lived closer to their parents and asked if he would ever consider moving back to Scotland. He then told Lowry that he was glad his children had Lowry for an uncle, and he knew Lowry would always look after them. Lowry later said he had the feeling Ian was telling him goodbye. Let me pause for a minute. I am excited to announce the release of the audiobook of my novel, Massacre at Bear Creek Lodge, read by Beth Chaplin. Listen to an excerpt.
Chapter 4, Saturday, September 6th, 10:27 a.m. Patterson and Peter Boyle stood in Jules and Bob's bedroom, afraid to move. There was so much blood in the room that they couldn't take a step without contaminating the crime scene. Patterson snapped several photos of the room from his vantage point by the door, but he needed to move closer to get photos of the victims. Both he and Peter had donned boot covers and nitrile gloves before entering the room, and now he stepped carefully toward the bed, attempting to avoid the blood spatters. The killer had beaten the heads of both victims so severely that they were barely recognizable as humans. He could only assume the couple in the bed were Bob and Jules Bartlett. Nothing he'd seen yet contradicted this identity of the victims. But what if Bob had caught Jules in bed with someone else and had beaten them both to death? He needed to keep an open mind at this early stage in the investigation. Patterson fought back nausea while he photographed the victims. Blood matted the woman's long dark hair. She lay on her stomach with her smashed-in face turned to the side on the pillow. Much of the left side of her head and face were missing. Elle said she'd touched the bodies, so he would need to check with her and find out how the bodies had been positioned when she found them. From the looks of the damage to Jules Bartlett, though, Patterson guessed she'd been sleeping in this position when someone bludgeoned her with a sharp object. She must have been murdered in her sleep. At least she never saw what was coming. Patterson guessed she was the first victim. The man lay on his back with his arms over his head, as if he had tried to fend off the blows. "Did you see a murder weapon?" Patterson asked Peter. "No, sir," Peter said. He still stood by the door, and when Patterson glanced back at him, he noticed how pale he looked. "You okay?"
"Yes, sir," Peter said. "It's just that..." He paused. "I've never seen anything like this."
"Me either," Patterson said. "These two don't even look human. I'd say the killer used an axe. It's the only weapon I can think of that could inflict this much damage."
"Yes, sir," Peter said again.
Patterson continued to snap photos, and then he and Peter stood in the room, trying to move as little as possible while still getting a feel for the crime scene. A knock sounded on the bedroom door, and Peter opened it.
"Crime scene is here, sir," he said to Patterson.
Patterson let out a long breath, relieved to have an excuse to get out of this room for a while.
The audiobook version of Massacre at Bear Creek Lodge is available at Audible, Amazon, and iTunes. Even though McIntosh had been retired from the Navy for 4 years, he was required to report to the Foreign Office before leaving England, even for a short vacation. This requirement did not apply to most retired naval officers, and Ian's brother Lowry believes that Ian still played a role in acquiring knowledge on his foreign visits. Whether or not Ian's role was active or passive remains a matter of speculation. Lowry said he was sorting through a box of Ian's photos after Ian disappeared. Mixed in with Ian's vacation snapshots, Lowry found several images of military airfields and installations. The pictures were taken from some distance away with a powerful telephoto lens. McIntosh, Barber, and Insull flew directly from Honolulu to Anchorage. In 1979, Soviet bloc fishing trawlers prowled the waters near Alaska, and some of the trawlers were used as spy vessels. Although the American public wasn't aware of the spies or the many other dangers of the Cold War, the U.S. military and the U.S. intelligence agencies were well aware of them. The Soviets also plied the oceans near Europe. Of course, the Americans and British had their own methods of spying on the Soviet Union. The Kodiak tracking station, located at Chiniak, 50 miles southeast of the city of Kodiak, was part of a top-secret global surveillance network operated by the NSA. Its purpose was to use satellites to spy on the Soviet Union. This installation closed in 1975. On July 6th, McIntosh, Insull, and Barber visited Mount Denali National Park and then had dinner with one of Barber's friends, William McCumsky, an air traffic controller for the Federal Aviation Administration at Anchorage International Airport. McCumsky said that Barber told him the three had planned to fly to Juneau, but had changed their minds and decided to instead go to Kodiak. Barber did not explain why they had changed their minds. Barber would rent a plane for the trip and fly the trio to Kodiak. Neither Barber nor McIntosh seemed concerned about flying over an extended stretch of ocean in a single-engine wheel plane. But Susan Insull was not excited about the idea. She dreaded flying in small planes. According to McCumsky, Barber and McIntosh seemed surprisingly casual. He did not believe they carried survival equipment on the trip to Kodiak, and he thought they only took a large duffel bag containing personal articles, clothes, and camera equipment. Late the following morning, Barber went to the offices of Glacier Aircraft Sales at Merrill Field near Elmendorf Air Force Base and rented a Raleigh 235 for 4 days. A qualified Raleigh instructor met Barber at Glacier Aircraft Sales and took him for a test flight to familiarize him with the aircraft. A Raleigh 235 does not have doors, but employs a clear canopy, allowing the pilot and passengers a 180-degree view. The canopy folds up for entering and exiting the plane. A Raleigh is sometimes called a tin parachute because it is capable of slow, controlled flight, even without power. According to the Anchorage pilot who checked out Graham Barber in the Raleigh, Barber requested to practice power-off stalls during his familiarization with the plane. A power-off stall simulates an accidental stall that might occur during an approach to landing. Lowry found Barber's choice of airplane for the trip down to Kodiak interesting because he remembers Ian telling him the flying conditions in Alaska could be so dangerous that he would never fly in anything other than a twin-engine plane. Of course, pilots fly single-engine planes between Anchorage and Kodiak all the time and rarely have issues. Perhaps more curious than choosing a single-engine plane was picking an aircraft with a fixed landing gear, making it unfit for pontoons. Floats are standard on planes flown by bush pilots in Alaska. Before the test flight, the pilot fueled the plane to maximum capacity. The plane had enough fuel for approximately 5 hours of flying time. Barber did not refuel it for the trip to Kodiak because he knew he had more than enough fuel for the flight. In his flight plan, Barber indicated a route to Whittier and then on to Kodiak. He did not specify if he planned to land in Whittier. Kodiak Island lies 250 air miles southwest of Anchorage. With no stops, the flight could take 45 minutes. The weather was clear with unlimited visibility and light winds. The conditions were perfect for the flight. Barber, McIntosh, and Insull departed Merrill Field at 2:30 p.m. on Sunday, July 7, 1979. At 5:22 p.m., Barber radioed the Homer Flight Service Station and requested to extend the flight plan by 1 hour. By then, the plane had been in the air for 2 hours and 52 minutes. Where had Barber flown? Were they sightseeing? Perhaps they had landed somewhere for a while, but no one reported seeing the plane land. If they had been in the air for 2 hours and 52 minutes, the plane only had 1 hour and 20 minutes of fuel remaining. At 5:45 p.m., 23 minutes after Barber had asked for a 1 hour flight extension, David Lutke, the air traffic controller at the air traffic control tower in Kodiak, received a mayday call from the Raleigh with the registration number N302RA. he immediately alerted the Rescue Coordination Center at the U.S. Coast Guard Air Station. Less than a minute later, a four-engine Lockheed C-130 airplane prepared to depart the Coast Guard airstrip to look for the plane in distress. Other aircraft in the area were also diverted. Barber told the control tower that he planned to try to make it to Shuyak Island at the northern end of the Kodiak Archipelago and find a place to land. The plane had a fixed landing gear, so he was probably hoping to find a beach where he could land. 4 minutes and 41 seconds after he'd issued his first mayday, Barber calmly told Kodiak, "Romeo Alpha, this will be our last transmission. We are 500 feet and about to go in." The last position Barber gave for the plane was near the tip of Shuyak Island. He told Ludke at the Kodiak Tower that he had negative oil pressure. Experts determined that Barber was steering the plane in a slow power-off glide when it splashed into the ocean. Planes with fixed gears often flip over when they attempt to land on water. How hard would it have been for the occupants of the Raleigh to remove the canopy and escape the sinking plane? Even if they did escape the plane, would they have been able to reach shore before hypothermia immobilized them and they drowned? Some experts suggest Barber chose the Raleigh to fly down to Kodiak for a specific reason. The sea conditions on the day the plane disappeared would have allowed a water landing, and the plane might not have flipped if piloted by an expert like Barber. Graham Barber specifically requested to practice power-off stalls with the pilot who checked him out on the plane in Anchorage. This is the same maneuver Barber would have needed to execute to stage a crash landing at sea. Experts estimated the Raleigh could have stayed on the surface for approximately 30 minutes. If the plane landed right side up, the canopy would have provided the passengers a much easier exit than doors. However, if McIntosh, Barber, and Insull escaped the plane, where did they go? Did another aircraft or boat rescue them and whisk them away to a clandestine destination? A coordinated search effort for the missing plane commenced immediately. Three helicopters and a C-130 searched an area covering 900 square miles for 18 hours. The following day, the Coast Guard cutter Boutwell, two helicopters, and two C-130s crisscrossed the search area for 21 hours, covering 3,000 square miles. The Coast Guard ended the search on July 10th, pending further developments. No signs of the Raleigh aircraft or its three passengers were found during the search or since. The NTSB determined that oil failure was the most likely reason for the crash, but without the plane, no one could determine the cause of the negative oil pressure. In his transmissions to the Kodiak Tower, Barber did not say he had an oil leak or that he could see oil blowing out from under the engine cowling. Furthermore, the searcher saw no evidence of an oil slick on the water. One expert postulated that someone checked the oil and forgot to replace the cap. This would cause the oil to slowly leak out of the engine until the engine seized. There is no proof to support this theory. It is only one of the many theories about what happened to Graham Barber, Ian McIntosh, and Susan Insull. U.S. authorities notified the British consulate in Anchorage, Alaska, on the day McIntosh, Insull, and Barber disappeared. On July 9th, the Alaska State Troopers notified their families in Great Britain. On the same day, the Kodiak Daily Mirror ran a 7-inch bare-bones story about the aircraft's disappearance. The report named the three passengers on the plane, but listed McIntosh's first name as Ivan instead of Ian. The article in the Anchorage Daily News was about the same length. On July 10th, the Anchorage Daily News ran a longer story, but mistakenly identified McIntosh and Insull as British broadcast journalists. The news did not find its way to the London newspapers until Wednesday, July 11th, and by July 12th, it topped the news in Great Britain. Rumors began to spread throughout England. Suddenly, it seemed as if the fictional drama Sandbaggers might be real. Did the mysterious Ian McIntosh die in a plane crash? Or were Russian spies hot on his trail, and was the appearance of a plane crash only a cover for McIntosh to go underground? Some even speculated that he had defected to the Soviet Union. Misinformation only added to the mystery. On July 12th, the London Daily Telegraph quoted a Coast Guard spokesman as saying the Raleigh went down in 40-foot waves and breaking ice. No Coast Guard spokesman would have made such a statement. There is no ice in the Gulf of Alaska, especially in July, and the seas when the plane disappeared were mostly calm with a slight swell. The NTSB did not consider weather to be a contributing factor to the incident. The producers, director, cast, and crew of The Sandbaggers continued the show's third season, and the producers hired writers to finish the last three scripts. However, without Ian's guiding hand and tightly written scripts, the producers did not feel the show could continue for a fourth season. Whitehall, Great Britain's government center in London, offered no comment in the aftermath of Ian McIntosh's disappearance. And the government's silence created more drama and suspicion surrounding the disappearance of a distinguished Royal Navy officer and suspected spy. According to Lowry McIntosh, British intelligence officers swept Ian's home near London before Ian's disappearance was known to the general public. Ian's friend, who had a key to his house to water his plants and collect his mail while he was gone, said Ian's home was under surveillance by special branch officers parked nearby in a car. The friend noticed someone was watching Ian's house even before he received the news that Ian was missing. Lowry said Ian's home was full of electronic devices, which were much more sophisticated than one would use to protect against thieves. Was Ian still working for British intelligence? Was there more to his trip to Alaska than just a vacation? Lowry approached a friend in U.S. intelligence to find out what had happened to his brother in Alaska. The friend advised Lowry to stop asking questions and to just leave things as they were. The Ministry of Defense in London told Ian's ex-father-in-law, a Royal Navy admiral, the same thing when he asked questions about Ian's disappearance. Did Ian McIntosh, Susan Insull, and Graham Barber die when their plane crashed into the ocean near Kodiak Island? While many in London found the idea of a plane disappearing without a trace preposterous, Alaskans know it happens too frequently. However, perhaps something more mysterious or sinister occurred. Ian could have gone undercover for British intelligence or defected to the Soviet Union. Author Robert Folsom said there is some information he regretted not including in his book about Ian McIntosh. When Folsom talked to retired FAA flight controller David Lutke, the man who spoke with Graham Barber as the Raleigh lost altitude, Lutke said he still has unresolved questions about the crash. He wondered why the Coast Guard did not deploy a helicopter immediately after he reported the Mayday call. After all, if there were survivors in the water, the Coast Guard would need the search and rescue helicopter to rescue them. He said a U.S. State Department official suggested that the crash might have been staged. He said other FAA officials told his boss not to worry about the people on the airplane because, quote, they are all in Russia by now. Lutke said he heard this information third hand, and at the time he considered it nothing more than office gossip. However, now he wonders if there was some truth in what he heard. Lowry dismissed the idea of Ian defecting to the Soviet Union and said he was very loyal to his country. Lowry suggested it could have been that for some reason Ian had to disappear, perhaps because he was under threat from the Russians or a terrorist organization like Black September. He had a family he loved, but he would have disappeared if he'd had to. No one ever reported seeing Ian McIntosh, Susan Insull, or Graham Barber again after they disappeared in Alaska. While McIntosh might have agreed to go deep undercover as a spy in the Soviet Union or decided to hide in some remote corner of the world to protect his family from retaliation by a terrorist organization, would Graham Barber and Susan Insull have agreed to go with him? It seems unlikely. Still, Lowry McIntosh said Ian sent a postcard to his parents posted the day before he disappeared. On it, instead of writing, "Love, Ian," McIntosh clearly wrote, "Live, Ian." In 2004, Lowry said, "I remain convinced he was no longer on that plane when it was ditched in the sea, and he certainly never died on that day." Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you to my patrons for your support. Check out the show notes for more information on how you can support this podcast and unlock extra episodes by joining the Last Frontier Club. If you haven't already done it, be sure to join the Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier Facebook group and chat about the podcast. I'll see you soon for the next episode of Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.